Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us. This is the third in a weekly series of briefings by the Lieutenant Governor and the Baker-Polito administration and key officials to provide a key briefing to all municipal chief executive officers regarding the state's response and coordination with cities and towns on the COVID-19 public health emergency. We appreciate, my name is Jeff Beckwith. I'm the executive director of the MMA, and we're providing the platform for this webinar, this briefing. After we have a presentation by the administration and key officials, we will then entertain questions via the chat function that can be found for those that are joining us via computer or the app on a smartphone. I would like to extend on behalf of the MMA and cities and towns all across the Commonwealth our deep appreciation to the leadership of the governor and lieutenant governor. And Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, just would turn the program over to you to lead this briefing for municipal officials from across Massachusetts. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and thank you all for obviously being on the call, but more so what you and your teams are doing day to day to combat COVID-19 and more so to protect the people of your community and our Commonwealth. We identify as heroes the individuals who put themselves literally in contact with people who are either known or unknown to them to have COVID-19 and are sorting through how that works and literally going home at the end of a shift and thinking about how they decontaminate so that they don't infect family and loved ones around them. These are very challenging times, as we all know. I also want to just remind you that we have daily briefings, the governor and our team with our COVID command center, and those briefings are memorialized in writing and are distributed through Jeff to all of you. They contain a lot of essential information for you, and I hope that you are keeping up with that status on a daily basis. I'd like to run down a few areas with you at this moment. Thank you to all of you for working through what we know as the first municipal bill to address certain areas, actually a number of bills combined to do so. Thank you so much. And we know that there's another municipal bill working its way through the legislative process now that contains some information around the Student Opportunity Act and MCAS. We will be working with the legislature to see that processed hopefully soon. Regarding essential services, you know that we followed federal government's adjustment to the essential services list and made further modifications to our essential services order, which asks all non-essential businesses to keep their physical workplaces and facilities closed to workers, customers, and the public until May 4th. This extension with the updated list and a detailed FAQ is on the COVID-19 website. That FAQ list does get further modified as we hear from individuals that have questions when there's an area that may not appear clear to them. We know for you as municipal leaders, being enforcement authorities through your boards of health, often have questions around what they should do around essential or non-essential workplaces and continue to work through Jeff and our office or through HED's online portal that addresses these kinds of inquiries so that we can provide you further guidance. We've been able to update the guidance around construction. There was a lot of questions over the past week around what that would look like. We also was able to put together a safety protocol for construction projects that are ongoing in your community and how to enforce the safety protocols. And also, if there is a need for inspectional services to support your local inspectional services, we have capacity to connect you to those resources as well. I did want to update you on the grocery guidance. As you know, groceries, pharmacies are essential services that need to be available to people day to day. Groceries have a lot to manage in terms of keeping their shelves stocked with the foods and materials needed for their customers, and at the same time keep their workforce safe and also have ample time to stock shelves so that these goods and products can be available when there's public hours. We have received a lot of information throughout the Commonwealth that there is a sort of a random approach to how to do this and a need for us to be clearer in terms of what we are providing for guidance around grocery stores. The Department of Public Health is released today or later today an update on what is permitted. And I'll give you a rundown and you can go to the COVID-19 website and access this information later today. For grocery stores, there will be a limit on occupancy to 40% of its maximum permitted occupancy level in order to provide for in-store social distancing while preserving sufficient access for the public to supplies of food and necessities. This occupant count will include customers and employees, and local boards of health are not to prescribe or enforce any different limitation on occupancy levels. That's an important point. We're striking at what we think a safe place to be, that both grocers, public health guidance, as well as you on the community level have given us so much input. We feel this is the right place to be, but making it more difficult for groceries to operate beyond what we're providing for guidance will inhibit the ability for people to access the food and resources they need. So we would ask you to look at that, study that, and if you have further information or guidance that you need, you can reach out to us through Jeff. If problems arise in a grocery store, local boards of health should make all efforts to address the concerns with the grocery store instead of seeking additional punitive measures, which just underscores the need for everyone to use common sense, but also to make it safe for both the public as well as the workforce there. We also issued further guidance on hotels, motels, and short-term rentals like Airbnb. This was particularly a challenge for communities in the Berkshires as well as on the Cape and the islands, where we were seeing a lot of people coming into the Commonwealth from other places to occupy these locations for more vacation and leisure time. At a particular time in this crisis that we need to reduce the inflow of people coming to our Commonwealth. So we have issued an order limiting the purposes for short-term rentals to only be there for the essential workforce, the frontline health workers fighting COVID-19. So that you should also be aware of. I would like to also just give you an update on PPE. We do have another call with first responders, but I think it's also important to share with you that they need, obviously, the gear to be able to do their jobs safely. You've heard some good news over the course of this past week about personal protective equipment and our access to more masks and gowns and the kinds of things needed for your workforce, whether it's through the shipment that came through the Kraft family from China or with New Balance and Lawrence repurposing their manufacturing floor to making non-surgical masks. These efforts are undergoing daily to create more capacity for masks, gowns, to help fortify our first responders throughout the Commonwealth. On testing, so not only gear, but testing is also critically important to our frontline. Lowell is a testing site for emergency responders open today. You saw over the weekend that we opened Lot 50 at Gillette for emergency responders, both of those by appointments. We are considering two additional locations, one in Springfield area and an additional opportunity in central Massachusetts to replace the CVS Shrewsbury site that came offline today. So more coming there. You will hear from Faye on shelters. We did a lot of work over the course of this week with all of you, using the guidance that we get from our expert advisory group around the surge expectancy coming obviously soon. We expect that based upon the numbers somewhere around April 10th to April 20th, so that's literally upon us, using their guidance to determine how, where, when we set up shelter space. We have a statewide plan for shelter space, utilizing hotel space for isolation beyond quarantine. Faye can talk to you a little bit more about the difference there. She can also talk with you about FEMA reimbursement for costs that you incur associated with setting up shelter in your community and what regional opportunities could be also available to you. I would like to just speak briefly on nursing homes. This is also an issue that's come up a lot this past week as we see more cases of residents of nursing homes being tested positive. We have a mobile testing system in place, largely with our National Guard, testing symptomatic residents of nursing homes as well as staff, so ramping up to a great level the amount of testing in our nursing homes. And later today, you will be getting guidance for your first responders. Many of them have asked how to respond to a nursing home call when the status of a nursing home resident would be in question. And the guidance will be something along the lines of assuming that a response to a call at a nursing home does involve a COVID-19 positive patient. I am now going to just bring your attention to one finance matter, and then you're going to hear from both Sean Cronin on finances, and you'll hear from Faye Boardman on shelters. On finance, briefly, the CARES Act, receiving a lot of calls from many of you around the CARES Act funding and when that is going to reach the Commonwealth so that it then reaches the cities and towns. We all know that the CARES Act includes $150 billion nationally, and that means somewhere around $2.7 billion for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The money will flow from the federal government to the Commonwealth before being distributed to municipalities, except for Boston, because they have a population over 500. We are waiting for additional guidance from the U.S. Treasury so that we know how to distribute, when we will receive the funds, and then how to quickly turn those funds over to you for the allowed ineligible expenses that you are incurring. I think we've made you aware of this before, but just goes without saying that it's really important that you are tracking all COVID-19 expenditures separately in your accounting so that when there is a need to be able to access either CARE Act funds or apply for reimbursement through the FEMA disaster declaration, that you're organized and have already have in place a system for tracking these expenses. So with that, I just want to again say thank you all very, very much. Thank you, Jeff, for hosting, and I will turn it over to Sean Cronin, and I look forward to hearing the questions that you will raise at the end of the briefing.
All right. Can you hear me, Jeff?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Hunter, and thank you, Sean, for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. So just briefly, as the Lieutenant Governor noted, the governor signed the bill into law last Friday. And I know we covered it last Tuesday, but just a couple things to highlight. There's a section in there that will allow a process for municipality to go into fiscal 21 and spend funds via a minimum 112 budget if you can't get a budget approved for fiscal 21 by June 30th. There's also a provision in there that will allow cities and towns to be able to use free cash certified, well, that would otherwise end on June 30th, to be able to use that in fiscal 21 before your next free cash is certified. It also provides you the opportunity, if you want, to amortize any emergency-related deficit over a three-year period. And there's a section that has a couple provisions in there about extension of property tax bills and exemptions to June 1st, and another one related to waiving late fees and interest costs associated with unpaid property tax bills, excise bills, et cetera. And I do want to note that we did send out a bulletin last Friday that provided guidance on all of the municipal finance-related sections of the bill. And just short time ago, I believe, we sent out additional guidance clarifying one piece, which was specific to notifying your residents, your taxpayers, about the extension of due dates for tax bills. Originally, guidance said that you had to do that via a mailing. The updated guidance allows you to use current technologies to do that, including your website, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, other push technologies like the Verse 911. So you have the opportunity to use other communication tools to address that. There were also a couple of sections related to local permitting, which I know we talked about last week. And there was also the provision in there to allow restaurants to include beer and wine as part of takeout orders. So I'll stop there and leave time for any questions and answers on that going forward.
Thank you very much. Now I believe, Faye, are you going to speak to us about shelters? Trying to find, is there someone who's going to
speak? I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now. Thank you.
Perfect. I had to unmute myself. this is Faye Boardman. I am part of the shelter work stream at the command center. Thank you so much for inviting myself, Sam, and Elizabeth and Tom to this meeting. My team and I are working on the response planning efforts for the homeless population. Some of our main objectives have been to stand up regional isolation and recovery centers for the homeless population. Now, these centers are for those individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19, or if a doctor presumes them positive because they exhibit all the symptoms associated with COVID-19. So the only people that are in these isolation and recovery centers are COVID-19 homeless individuals. We're going to, later on, we're going to go into a little bit more detail of how we stood these up and what goes into all the many facets of activating one of these centers. So the next part that we have been focusing on has been to establish one-on-one partnerships to support the municipalities and shelter providers who are planning and establishing quarantine sites. We've also been able to provide logistical and technical supports to communities establishing regional quarantine sites. Now, a quarantine site are for individuals who may have been exposed to someone who is COVID-19 positive, but are not exhibiting any symptoms and have not tested positive. So they need to be separated from the healthy individuals, but they are not positive, so they wouldn't go into the regional isolation and recovery centers. So you're kind of separating them out so that if they end up needing to be testing positive, then we would be separating them. So what we've identified is there really is no kind of cookie cutter approach to setting up these quarantine sites. So my team and I have worked really closely with the communities to construct heated tents being set up next to shelters. We've been working with communities of identifying gyms or high school field houses to be used as quarantine sites and to be thinking about utilizing unused space in buildings near the shelters. We've been trying to focus and encourage shelters and communities to think about quarantine sites close to or next to the shelters is because you're able to utilize some of the same resources in the shelters. With all of this, as you can tell, just with PPE, but staffing as well, there are just limited resources. So we're trying to capitalize on what is already currently there in order to not stretch those resources further. We also, my team and I have also been processing requests for PPE and cleaning supplies for many of the shelter sites. And we've also been providing guidance and FAQ documents. So we have almost routinely every day are communicating to the shelter providers, getting updates on what the progress they are doing to depopulate their individuals, how they're setting up quarantine sites, if there's anybody, you know, experienced symptoms or if they have COVID-19 positive individuals. So we work really closely with that. And a lot of the questions that have come about, we've put guidance and FAQ documents together, and we continue to add guidance to the DPH website. So we have one that is guidance for the individual homeless shelters. There's guidance, there's an FAQ for the COVID-19. Homeless shelters. And then there's an FAQ we put together for cities and towns regarding the FEMA reimbursement for quarantine and isolation solutions. So that's a little bit of the higher level things of what we've been actively doing within our work stream. I'm going to just go a little bit into the FEMA reimbursement guidelines. If Sam could just provide some of the key points that would be helpful for the people on this call.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Hopefully you can hear me. I think I'm unmuted.
Yes, and this is for everyone. This is Sam Phillips, the director of MEMA. Thank you, Sam, for joining us.
Great. So to recap, the Commonwealth received a major disaster declaration signed by the president very late March. I think March 28th is the exact date. And so that affords reimbursement up to 75% of eligible expenses in the categories of emergency protective measures. So there's a program called public assistance. And for those of you on the phone, your teams of colleagues, you know, particularly at the emergency management level, particularly, you know, law enforcement and fire chief level, are very familiar with working with us at MEMA on recouping costs post-disaster. And so this is the same program that we're using. We're just using it for COVID-19. In addition to that, we obtained special permission to expand a category of eligibility around non-congregate sheltering. So this is leveraging resources such as hotels or potentially dormitory spaces. So any kind of housing program that people wouldn't be in sort of a large gymnasium setting or kind of a large hall of sorts, this is where it's like, you know, we're sort of pairing one person to one room. And that eligibility includes first responders and healthcare workers who need to quarantine safely without exposing their families, homeless families with at least one member who has tested positive for COVID-19, who live in congregate shelters and will require isolation. And thirdly, homeless individuals who require quarantine or isolation. So the programs that Faye just walked through are kind of eligible and part of, are sort of captured within this eligibility from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. All of this documentation is on LEMA's website, and we're linked to the overall COVID page as well. And we have technical assistance available. We're doing webinars at least on a weekly basis with local communities. So I think as the Lieutenant Governor started off by saying, the best thing to do right now is to ask questions if you have them. If you're going to launch a new program, check with us for eligibility. We can help you make sure you're doing it in accordance with what's allowable, so you get the most reimbursement available to you, and just really start to document your costs. I think I'll stop. Oh, we had one question actually that came up on a call on Sunday evening about how is homelessness defined? And we actually spoke to FEMA today, and it's the state can define, so how we would define homelessness, the federal government will use our interpretation of homelessness. So we're looking at sort of like pre-disaster, pre-COVID homelessness, or pre-COVID unstably housed. So I'll stop there, and we can take any questions in the Q&A on this part.
Thanks, Sam. So we're gonna move on to our isolation recovery centers. We're gonna give kind of a high overview of what went into standing up one of these, the wraparound, the intake process, just to kind of give you how kind of complex it is. And then as we kind of start to stand these up, you'll know a little bit more about them. So these isolation recovery centers, they're regional sites that we're looking for. We have, they are for, as I mentioned before, individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19. Our first site is at the Aloft Hotel in Lexington, Mass. And our next site will be opening in the next day or two will be in Pittsfield, Mass. And we're actively looking at other sites across the Commonwealth. We need to be identifying the clinical support for each one of those regional sites. So there's a lot of logistical staffing components that go into activating these. So as we're putting the playbook together, we want to make sure that we've put all the resources there before we keep standing these up. So we'll have two by the end of this week, which is really great. So I want to kind of go into a little bit of the kind of wraparound services. The cleaning the food and those kind of things that we had to put. I didn't know, Sam, if you wanted to kind of touch upon some of those key components.
Sure. So part of wraparound. I think you can hear me now. So some of the wraparound services that Faye has described is, I think first and foremost, making sure that there's private security at each hotel. And a lesson learned as we're bringing these online is we're also reaching to local law enforcement to see if they could and would like to have a security presence at the hotels as well, at the recovery and isolation centers. If they can't, we can partner with state police to have kind of a uniform presence. We're learning that the combination of both private security and then either a local or state law enforcement official is a helpful combination. That security is on presence 24/7. The second piece is, you know, three meals a day, bringing food in to support, you know, for both the workers and for individuals, for the staff at the facilities and for individuals staying at the facilities. We've also coordinated to have a cleaning service come in that will clean the rooms and, you know, clean the entire facility. And potentially do some laundry. Some of this is on a case-by-case basis with what the arrangement has been made with the hotel. And then the last piece is on transportation. So actually through a partnership with Sheriff Kochi out of Hamden, We have a transportation solution identified that can help get people, you know, potentially from a shelter or as they're leaving the hospital to the hotel location.
Great, thanks, Sam. Now I'm going to hand it over to Elizabeth from my team, who has been actively working on the operational functions within these sites. She's going to kind of walk us through what it takes to from filling out the form intake process until they are ready to leave. Elizabeth?
Perfect. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So I'll go over, like Faye said, the kind of overview from intake to the on-site services to the discontinuation of isolation process on the site. At a high level. So for intake, as Faye gave an overview of already, the initial contact, referring agencies and organizations can be hospitals who are discharging an individual, homeless shelter providers who have an individual in the community, or emergency service agencies that may contact our statewide intake vendor to ensure eligibility for the program, register their client or resident for the program, and then get the guest placed and transported to the nearest isolation and recovery site that's currently accepting placements. So the intake vendor will help us coordinate a pickup and drop-off time. They'll assign the guest to a room, and they'll alert that isolation and recovery site that the guest will be arriving shortly. When they arrive to the site, there will be a 24/7 clinical monitoring team there. I do want to emphasize that these isolation and recovery sites are for individuals who, should be isolating at home, but may need some medical monitoring on site and other supports like behavioral health to allow them to safely complete their isolation and recovery period, protecting both themselves and their communities. But these are not. This is not a step-down level of care. These individuals do not need clinical level or acute medical care. That said, the clinical monitoring team that we have on site to ensure everyone's safety includes 24/7 nursing support to round on guests. So they do the initial intake with the individual, going over their symptoms of COVID, any co-occurring conditions, background information on their medications so that we can ensure continuity of their medications while on site. They also will be rounding on individuals in the hotel twice a day, checking vitals, monitoring symptoms, and helping guests manage chronic conditions that may be, flaring up during this time, that they're infected with COVID. We also have a number of behavioral health specialists through the DMH PATH program, which is the Project for Assistance in Transition from Homelessness, to work with us and send social workers and LICSWs on site to work with our individuals on a number of things, connecting them to telepsychiatry, telecounseling, recovery coaching, linkages to existing mass health programs, for instance, like behavioral health community partner programs. So they're on site providing that service to guests who may need it. And then we have medication continuation support set up with our colleagues at UMass and in Mass Overdose that are supporting the sites in ensuring that prescriptions are transferred to nearby pharmacies and that the appropriate prescriptions are being delivered on site so that we can ensure that, members who may be used to going to pick up their own prescriptions at the pharmacy are able to receive these medications and continue on their medication regimes while in the isolation site for the period necessary. And then the other two things to highlight are we have iPads available at the sites for telehealth appointments. To the extent possible, we want to keep individuals connected with their usual sources of care and providers, whether that's a primary health clinician, a psychiatrist, another behavioral health practitioner. And then we have 24/7 interpretation and translation available for individuals who might not have English as a first language so that our nursing support team and others on site are able to communicate with everybody that's there. So those are some of the supports that we have and services on site. And then as far as the exit process, we have a discontinuation of isolation protocol that the nurses follow following our DPH criteria for when an individual is eligible to discontinue isolation and to identify these individuals. We have a standardized form that the nursing staff will fill out, keeping a form for their records, alerting the local board of health so that and the testing provider so that MAVEN can be updated, and then giving a copy to the individual for reentry into the shelter. This provides our shelter communities with an assurance that they have been, you know, clinically identified to meet the criteria for discontinuation of isolation. And then we have a warm handoff protocol when an individual is ready to go back into the community after their stay at an isolation and recovery site, including notifying the shelter that sent the individual to us, the local board of health, like I said, the testing provider to update Maven, providing transportation for the individual to go back to their community, and ensuring that they have a supply of food and prescription medications that they may need immediately after leaving. The guest leaves, we have the logistics of cleaning the room and decontaminating, and then turning it over for a new guest. So that's kind of the overview of how the intake, on-site services, and exit from the isolation and recovery sites works.
Thank you, Elizabeth and Faye and Sam, for such a comprehensive briefing on the issue of shelters. I do note that we have probably about 20 questions in the chat function. I wanted to make sure we have time to get to those. If people who are listening and participating in this briefing have further questions, can you give us the contact information where people can go to follow up on the issue of shelters?
Yes. They can, it would be Tom, but you can send it to me. Can we follow up through an email maybe and provide it that way?
We will provide, post it on the MMA website, the contact information for people who have further questions on the issue of shelters and coordination and collaboration with the state. It's very impressive and very complex, and we know that there will be some questions on those matters. We did include in the reminder notice for this email that went out on Monday the three documents that you mentioned, the FAQs, the guidance from municipalities, and the information on NEMA, FEMA reimbursement. So we'll continue to push that information out in the contact information.
That would be great.
So thank you very much. I did want to take advantage of having so many officials here from the administration to see if we could move into the questions part to explain to the well over 200 people who are participating. There is a chat function. People can submit questions via the chat. We have a very large number of questions right now. The questions are not all visible to the participants based on how they've been submitted via chat. But what I'd like to do is to categorize them and go through, and if we could have brief responses to as many of these as possible, that would be very helpful. The first I will say, and this is likely for Sean and Lieutenant Walker, there are a number of questions just raising concerns about the financial, the fiscal, and the budget impact of this public health emergency and the coming recession, and a lot of concern about getting timely information regarding what the impact will be potentially on cities and towns. Do you have any broad, and that includes either lost revenue that goes directly to cities and towns or funding for local aid? We know that there was a hearing that was scheduled today that had to be postponed because of technical difficulties for a consensus revenue forecast to revise that for the Commonwealth. But is there anything that the administration can share more specifically about either timing or general guidance on these budget issues that communities are concerned about?
Well, we continue to monitor our revenues as you do locally, and at the same time monitor the federal government funding to states that can trickle down to the community level. This is a work in progress. Today's hearing postponement is obviously a part of this to gain consensus about projected revenue for this fiscal year and next fiscal year. And we will continue to monitor, plan, and advise you as we develop our analysis and make certain decisions and conclusions. That we have nothing more to add to that right now.
Thank you. We know that we've had an extremely strong partnership between cities and towns and your administration regarding local aid. And we know that cities and towns are a top priority, and everyone is trying to figure out how to budget going forward. And so everyone recognizes the challenges that you are facing, because they're facing those as well. So we look forward to working with you to get as much information out whenever it's available to the communities of the state. So I will just see if we can walk through a number of questions. There's a question of, is there a directory of hotels where communities can put first responders in if they're positive for COVID-19 and don't want to go home and infect their families? Do you have a central listing of where communities might be able to seek out hotels?
Some of this is being done at the community level, making decisions in a municipality about how to do that. Some emergency responders are finding their own locations for quarantine isolation, and there may be some that MEMA is also tracking. Sam, can you speak to what you have insight into in terms of bed capacity for emergency responders?
Yeah, sure. So at this point, we are providing technical assistance. We are able to, some of the same tracking tools that we're using for the isolation and recovery hotels, the kind of input process needs to also be used for first responders. So we can share those tools. I know that in Hamden County, they're looking at a regional first responder location. We are working with some dormitories to see if we could replicate that to provide sort of regional locations at this point. But I, as Lieutenant Governor described, a lot of this is happening at the local level. Some of these locations, you know, and I think doing it at the local level is great. It keeps the first responder in the community. But we're actively working on how we could try to help support this at the state level, just recognizing the competing demand on various shelter programs that we're trying to support.
DPH, did you also provide guidance about when an emergency responder can go back into the workplace after testing?
We are working on that. So not so much. So after testing is more easy. If somebody actually, if a first responder has COVID disease, we use the usual clearance criteria. We have made an internal decision that first responders can go back to work and undergo symptom monitoring and wear a mask during after an exposure. And that's something that we're just moving through channels now, but I expect that to come out shortly.
Thank you. And we will, if you share that with us, we will push it out to all of the municipal CEOs who are participating in this briefing and post it on the MMA website as well. Another question, a follow-up on, thank you for the announcement on grocery stores. There was a question as to whether or not grocery stores could elect to have further limits on occupancy below the 40% level.
Guidance is applicable to grocery stores. It does not apply to liquor or convenience stores or stores with a maximum occupancy of 25 persons or less. And I would just caution you and the boards to go into an area that's stricter than this guidance. We did a lot of work with municipals, with the grocers, and with the public health department to come up with a reasonable and safe way to allow for stores to be stocked, allow for customers to come in safely, and allow for workers to be safe. And we feel that this guidance reflects a lot of analysis done already. There's also an opportunity for a grocer to offer online delivery and curbside pickup that will continue. And we ask that you study these and try to work between your local board and the grocer to address any issues that arise locally.
Thank you very much. Another question is, have there been any decisions on school reopening or remaining closed until the end of the year, knowing this will help communities plan remote learning programs?
We are continuing to monitor that. We know that this is a challenge for parents, for students, for educators, principals, superintendents, all throughout the Commonwealth and the country. There are online opportunities that have been available to most students. Not every student has access to the technology or to the special services needed for their education, so it's a very challenging time period. We will continue to monitor, and the department will establish what the next step will be for the remainder of the school year. And again, we are looking to the legislature to give us some of the wording that we've requested regarding MCAS and the Student Opportunity Act, and we'll be making further decisions. And we'll obviously advise you as soon as we make those decisions so that the locals can, school districts can implement.
Thank you very much. Let's see, we have a question as to whether or not local governments are notified when a firm's application to be deemed essential is rejected by the state, or is there a way that communities can get access to the list of enterprises that are determined to be non-essential and have received such a response back from the state?
Okay. There is extensive information on COVID-19 website around the essential services. I think people generally have an understanding of what essential is in terms of the workforce needed to deliver services, public safety, public health during the state of the emergency and the COVID-19 crisis. If there is a question regarding a non-essential business and the local Board of Health doesn't know what to do with that, you can go back through the HED channel to inquire and get further guidance. But there is an awful lot available to you. I wonder if the person asking the question has a specific industry or something happening that might be more common to other communities. If so, it might be worth stating that on the call.
So, Tom, you know who you are. If you want to type that in, I'll check to see whether or not it's specific or was a generic question. So that was an excellent suggestion, Lieutenant Governor. Here's another question. This has to do generally with the local enforcement on construction. And we can't thank you enough for the supplemental guidance that you issued to communities last week and the clarity regarding safety guidelines for these workplaces. The question is it the state that will impose penalties for non-compliance at private construction projects, or is that a local Board of Health function? And if it's Bob Ross that's answering, you're muted. Okay.
Just repeat the specific question.
The question was on essentially the enforceability of the guidelines, and the person who submitted the question is aware of a construction project that is in non-compliance. And the question is whether there will be state penalties, or is the enforcement primarily the function of the local Board of Health?
Yeah, the local Board of Health is empowered to enforce or make sure that the project site incorporates the safety protocols and can enforce the project owner to embed the safety protocols on the work site. So if there is an observed condition that is inconsistent with the safety protocols, the project owner needs to be made aware, and I would suggest an opportunity to correct and implement, and while putting the safety plan in place, pause the construction so that the workforce is not put in harm's way until a safety protocol acceptable to the Board of Health and local inspecting authority is in place.
Thank you.
And if the local inspector does not feel they have the bandwidth, have enough capacity within the department, especially some of the smaller communities, but want to see some construction move forward because it's important, whether it's affordable housing or a public building, then there are third-party inspectors that can be made available to the community for that purpose. And you can ask Jeff, we will provide you with contacts there, or we can work directly with you.
Thank you. Sean Cronin, there are a couple of questions seeking clarification on the due date for exemptions and deferrals. One question says that this seems to be intended for communities where the town hall was closed. And we are closed, but the public's to the public, but the staff is working, answering the phones and emails and accepting payments through an outdoor Dropbox. Does this apply to us too? Clarification on extending the due date for exemptions and deferrals.
No, the extensions for all 351 communities to adopt if they want. The provision that the questioner might be focusing on, it clarified the old language that dealt with when there was a blizzard or some other weather event and town hall was closed. We added public health to that. But that's just that one particular section. If you look at section 10, that's really the applicable one. That it's up to the cities and towns to make the decision of whether or not they want to delay the due dates. And then section 11, same thing, local option to waive interest and late payments.
And that that is at the municipal executive's option.
Yes, municipal executive being defined as mayor in a city and board of selectmen in a town.
Great, thank you. And then there was another question, but I believe you just answered it regarding the late payment and the waiver of penalties and interest. Again, that is an option that the communities can put in place.
Correct.
There are many questions. Many participants are just praising the Division of Local Services for clarifying the last week's bulletin with a supplemental bulletin regarding the notice on the waiving of penalties and interest. Another question here, it regards the Student Opportunity Act funds that were part of the legislation that was passed. The question is, will that act be revisited? Lieutenant Governor, I think you already answered that question by saying that there are just many questions that are being examined regarding the financial impact of the loss of revenue to the Commonwealth and to cities and towns. And the specifically when you mentioned the Student Opportunity Act in legislation, that was primarily around the upcoming obligations of developing plans and so on, as opposed to the funding levels. That's not in legislation that's currently pending, correct?
That's correct. The legislation that's before the Senate and the House includes language that would adjust what's necessary for communities to comply with the plan submission for the Student Opportunity Act. It does not include decisions around funding, which obviously will come as a result of our continued monitoring, assessment, and planning relative to revenues coming in and how to fund this year's budget and next year's budget.
And we have just 1 minute left. There are a few outstanding questions. I think many of them repeat. We'll follow up with you, Lieutenant Governor, with your team, and get those answers out, the ones that are available to our members and to local officials in the next meeting notice. So we thank you.
Jeff,
yes.
Jeff, let me just add that, because I see some finance-related questions. They can, any local official who has questions on any part of the bill that was signed into law, just email us at covid19dls@doi.state.gov.us, and that's our central intake for all these types of questions, and we'll turn them around quickly.
Excellent, thank you. And then we will compile the specific questions that came in regarding shelters and provide those to the in one central way to the team at the DPH/MEMA, and then push those answers back out. So we'll centralize that. So all the people who are listening here, if you have questions that you've put in the chat, you don't need to send those separately to Faye and Sam and Tom and Elizabeth. We'll take care of forwarding those. We've come to 2 o'clock. Lieutenant Governor, do you have any closing words for us? Thank you again for this briefing.
Oh, this is very helpful to have the weekly briefing and also the ability to respond to the questions that you have today and understand that this is fluid, right? Every day is different for us. So you don't need to wait for a weekly call or an opportunity like this to seek out our help or guidance. We want to make sure that you are armed with the resources, the information, so that you can make the best decisions possible at the moment that you're in. So thank you again. It's a team effort. We really appreciate what you're doing as our partners in this effort. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, and Governor Baker and all of the participants here and the everyone serving in public office, working to protect the public during this emergency. We appreciate your leadership more than we can say. Thank you very much. This concludes our meeting, the briefing today. We will follow up and provide notice of the next week's session as well. And we thank you all very much.